Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is March 31st, 2011. I'd like to thank our hundreds of listeners. I wish it was thousands. In addition to Alan, next week we will be having our special co-host, Greg Glazer, who is an expert in constitutional law. But today we have a lot of things to focus on, and for those people who are new listeners, I'd like to introduce Alan. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you doing? Or afternoon, I guess I should say.
Yeah, we're just about at the noon hour, and we're going to be doing that prayer for Dr. Emoto and Japan in a moment. But I'd like to just introduce you that Alan Phillips is a lawyer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. And that's what we've been talking about the last number of weeks, and we're going to continue in that vein. He has published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters. In fact, I just read a big article on Natural News that you just, I don't know when it was posted, but it's there. And he also appears at regular rallies, conferences on the radio and television. So welcome, Alan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here as always, Debbie.
Okay. So I'm also doing a meditation show every Sunday evening at 11 o'clock. And so we're going to kind of get into that mode in order to send positive waves, positive energy out into the universe around the globe to all the countries and the not only the living organisms, just the air, the water, and the earth, everything that is so much in dire need of our positive intentions. So this is a message that was sent out by Dr. Emoto asking the world to participate in a day of prayer in the wake of Japan's trauma and crisis. He says, send your prayers of love and gratitude to the water at nuclear plants in Fukushima. And we know that Dr. Emoto has been studying the properties of water and how just simple thoughts and words can change the structure of that water and what happens. He has many, many images of what happens to that water. So by the massive earthquakes of magnitude 9 and surreal massive tsunamis, more than 10,000 people are still missing. In fact, this morning I just read that the missing bodies will have to just be left and won't be able to go through their traditional funeral and burial services because the area is totally radioactive. And he says it's been 16 days since the disaster happened, and what makes it worse is that the water at the reactors at Fukushima nuclear plants started to leak, and we know from today's news that the cores are melting down. It's contaminating the ocean, the air, the water molecules of the surrounding areas. This is all what Dr. Emoto has been saying on his video. Human wisdom has not been able to do much to solve the problem, but we are only trying to cool down the anger of radioactive materials in the reactors by discharging the water to them. And so the way that he is viewing the problem is that this explosive radioactive material is an indication of an emotional anger. Is there really nothing else to do, he says. I think there is. During over 20 years of research at measuring water crystal photographic technology, he has been witnessing that water can turn positive when it receives pure vibration of human prayer, no matter how far away it is. The energy formula of Albert Einstein, E equals mc squared, really means that energy equals the number of people and the square of people's consciousness. Now it is time to understand the true meaning. Let us all join the prayer ceremony as fellow citizens of the planet Earth. He is asking all of us together, not just the people in Japan, but all around the world, to help find a way out of this crisis on the planet. And at noon, wherever you are, so that's how it goes around the world, because every place on the globe is going to do this prayer at their time, noon. Say these following phrases, and you can repeat it after me. The water of Fukushima nuclear plant. We are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you. And we love you. He says to say it aloud or in your mind. Repeat it three times as you put your hands together in a prayer position. And so I'm going to repeat that, those three lines, two more times. And if you wish, take a deep breath in and exhale. Just relax completely and thoroughly in your body, thinking positive thoughts. And again, the water of Fukushima nuclear plant. We are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. And the third time in unison around the world. The water of Fukushima nuclear plant. We are sorry to make you suffer. Please forgive us. We thank you and we love you. And he says thank you very much from his heart with love and gratitude, Dr. Emoto, Messenger of Water. And now that we have said our prayers, we're going to also continue with doing more than just intention, but actually acting. And part of the reason that we have this show every week is because we want to help people understand and exercise their rights and to learn the limitations of the legal system so that once they become learned, they can join others to take action. The development of an advocacy portal where people can work with others to make legislative changes and help expand our rights is now available at the National Vaccine Information Center, the www.nvic.org. And it's kind of a serious place that we're at, a sad place that we're at. And I had previously prepared something that was kind of lighthearted. I don't know whether it's appropriate to say it, but I do want to tell you that 50% of all the content that's consumed on Twitter is generated by 20,000 users. You could be part of that group if you get active and read and post and really participate wholeheartedly in Twitter to get the news out that you want other people to hear and be active. Alan, did you want to give the quote from Mary Holland?
Yes, I do. That's I just encountered this, and it's so well put. Mary Holland is a professor, a lawyer and professor, or a law school professor at New York University School of Law. And she is quoted as having said, "Vaccine choice is a fundamental human right. If a person can't decide what substances are injected into their bloodstream, then we don't live in a free society." And I tell you, when you phrase it like that, it's just really hard to understand, to wrap your mind around the whole concept of vaccine requirements. We're still rooted. Our law is still very much rooted in a history of the belief that vaccines are necessary for everyone, and that absence of a vaccine is something that puts everyone else at risk. And as long as that concept remains ingrained in our society and culture, in our beliefs, and probably more importantly, frankly, in our subconscious fears, then we're going to be struggling to change our society to one that really is a more rational one based on such fundamental concepts as Mary has expressed here. If you can't decide what substances are injected into your own bloodstream, you don't live in a free society. And I have to agree with that. Unfortunately, our legal system says different. And so it's up to us to become active, as you say, Debbie, to bring about the changes that will shift policy and law in favor of a more rational and sane policy.
Okay. Should I lighten it up with this little thing that I had a little thing of humor?
Go ahead, Debbie. Let's see if we can
transition
a little bit. This
was something that came through on Twitter, and I copied it and I retweeted it because, you know, I say every day, do a random act of kindness and retweet a stranger. So this was a piece of humor. It is a quote by Yogi Berra that says, "Today's deep thought, quote, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." I just thought that was hit the funny bone, and we need to kind of have a little lightness in our talk, even though we have very advocative, serious topics to discuss. We still have to keep our sense of humor and go forward together as a group, and we can do that. Also, I want to remind everyone that we do have 4 shows a week. On Monday, we're studying the Organon of Medicine and talk about healthcare. On Wednesday, which was yesterday, we talk about what do we talk about? we had
gardening.
A special, what is that?
Is that the gardening one?
We have organic gardening, but the last couple of weeks we've been talking about radiation and nuclear, the nuclear plants, so I kind of got off track. But there are things that we need to do for our planet and our soil and water and all that other stuff too. And so listen to yesterday's show. We had a special guest on, Phyllis Georgic. And today is vaccinations and your rights. And then on Sunday night at 11 is the meditation show. So you're going to tell us the latest news, that legislative action that has occurred in Washington State. Is that correct?
There's so many things to talk about. I keep saying this, but it's true. I keep thinking that things are going to slow up and we'll have a breather here, and I'll be wondering what are we going to talk about. And it turns out every week, Debbie, that there's just more to talk about than there's time to get in. There's concern about SB 5005 in Washington State. I thought that the proposed bill had passed. I have the impression now, perhaps it only passed one chamber of the state house there, because the bill has now been modified and reworded, and they addressed one of the fundamental issues that I had been talking and writing about as a constitutional problem, because the bill was set to require people exercising any kind of vaccine exemption to go through a medical professional. And to me, that just seemed fundamentally wrong, at least with regard to religious exemptions, because
maybe you need to set them up first. Are you saying that this was decided or not decided?
I'm of the impression right now that it has not been fully passed. The original version of it must have passed, and I apologize for my lack of clarity on this issue. And I'm saying this with regard to the natural
setup. Yeah, of what is this legislative action? Is this is Workman versus Mingo, the Fourth Circuit case?
That's a court case. You referred to Washington, and that's a legislative issue, so we have sort of two different issues there.
Set me straight on this.
That's fine. That Washington had a proposed bill that would require exemptions to get essentially be channeled through medical doctors, and to require somebody with religious objections to be counseled by a medical doctor just seemed fundamentally wrong. And as a matter of the federal legal precedent, the First Amendment only requires two things for religious exemption, and that's that you have beliefs that are religious in nature and that are sincerely held that are opposed to the immunizations. And Washington State was trying to add in another requirement, and that is that a medical doctor or naturopathic doctor sign off on these, and that just seemed fundamentally wrong to me. Well, apparently they have revised wording on that now, where they're not requiring people with religious would not be requiring people with religious exemptions to get a form signed by a doctor.
Okay.
But now the revised wording says, as long as the person is a member of an organized religion with tenets that are opposed to immunizations, that part violates the First Amendment as well, because the First Amendment says you need only have a belief that is religious in nature and sincerely held. So there is federal legal precedent that says flat out, it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion at all, nor does it matter which one you belong to if you do. So you can be Christian, Buddhist, just about anything but atheist, with or without organized religion affiliation, and still qualify for First Amendment protection. And First Amendment being federal law is a higher authority than state law. So when state laws craft a religious exemption, they have to do it in a way that it comports with the conforms with the First Amendment boundaries. So we still have problems in Washington State. I found out just this morning that the Tennessee General Assembly passed a Tennessee Health Freedom Act. Real excited about that. It looks in part to be something that's aimed at, and it does say, this new act, that you have the right in Tennessee to choose whether or not to purchase health insurance. It also says, though, that, let me see if I can find the exact language here, in effect that anybody can decide any form of health care that they want, that you're free to decide how you want to deal with your own health care issues, which suggests the possibility, and the person who emailed this to me made the same suggestion, that you know, couldn't this be used to refuse vaccines? Because it says here, you know, you can decide. The problem, unfortunately, and I always, you know, part of my job as attorney is to play devil's advocate, and unfortunately, sometimes my legal analysis comes up with an answer that I don't like. And this is one of those instances. The way that the Act defines health care services, to me, doesn't include vaccines, because it seems to be talking about caring for current physical illness or disease, injury, et cetera, whereas vaccines, of course, are a treatment for a future exposure to disease, and frankly, it's a hypothetical. In fact, there's two layers to the hypothetical. You may or may not ever be exposed to this future disease, but we're going to protect you from it in case you are. But everybody exposed, as I'm sure you know, Debbie, doesn't get sick either. So you have to be both exposed and develop symptoms, and vaccines have to actually work, you know, for the vaccine to do its job. But again, I think, well, we put it like this. If I was on the other side of this issue, if I was pro-vaccine, I would be arguing, and I would expect to win if it were to be an issue decided in court, that this Tennessee Health Freedom Act would not be something someone could use to say that they can avoid vaccines. If somebody uses it successfully to avoid vaccines, great. I'll be real happy. I'll be cheering right alongside with everybody else in the pro-vaccine choice community. I just don't think it can. But
that is a positive bit of news, is it not?
Oh, it certainly, absolutely is. It really opens
and
the
why
door.
And why would the state of Tennessee, of all states, be on the side of providing this Health Freedom Act?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I tell you, at first glance at the act, it looks to me like the right this seems to grant Tennessee residents to decide health care in the way that they want to. Of course, that would not be a completely unbounded right. You wouldn't be free to do something that would blatantly and obviously cause your children serious harm, for example. But it does open the door to that. It does seem to be an extension of the more prevalent concern around the country about whether or not the federal government can require state citizens to purchase health insurance,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the recent health care law. And so states are responding to that in a number of different ways, and this looks to me like it's Tennessee's or one of Tennessee's responses to the federal government's attempt to mandate that people have to purchase health insurance. To me, a fundamental overreach of the federal government, or at least that point within the larger federal health care law. But for whatever reason, Tennessee seems to have included language that extends beyond just the element of health insurance to say that people have a right to choose health care in a more general sense, not just with regard to health insurance.
I guess what I was asking was simply, you know, we have 50 states, and each of the states has a leaning toward being like liberal or conservative or constitutional law or whatever. And I was just wondering why, out of all the states, that Tennessee would provide. I mean, it's a hypothetical question because I don't know that you would know the answer. That was my question, really.
Well, we had a pendulum swing back in the direction of Republican with the last election, and there are, I don't know about Tennessee specifically, but there are states that were previously Democratic majorities that became Republican majorities, such as our state here in North Carolina. I don't know if that happened in Tennessee as well or if that factors into this. I mean, there's much as I would love to see issues passed or not passed on the true merits of the issues, politics plays a heavy role. And this certainly looks like the sort of thing that I would expect a Republican-led initiative to have, to be a Republican-led initiative and to be one that might be passed in a state with a Republican majority or with enough Democrats on board to get it done. But I don't know the details there for Tennessee.
Or maybe, you know, I don't know whether there are some major leaders or activists in particular states that are really pushing for certain legislation. And that could be another thing. I don't know who's there in Tennessee. So did you want to go on to the next issue that we're
going to
talk about?
Yeah, let's do that because this is the one I really wanted to sink our teeth into a little bit further today.
Okay.
We had a case a while back. It may have been even in 2009 originally. It was a federal court case in West Virginia concerning a mother who was claiming that her constitutional rights had been violated on several grounds when her daughter was refused school admission without immunizations in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
There were issues of both medical and religious exemptions involved in the case, and so it's particularly interesting because it gives us an opportunity to look at those issues and some of the constitutional issues with both medical and religious exemptions. And to some degree, in this case in particular, the interaction of those and how that affects constitutional rights. So it's a particularly interesting case in that regard. The part of the case that I was most aware of and focused on when I heard about it originally at the federal district court level concerned an argument on the side of the mother and her attorney that the Constitution requires states to offer a religious exemption. And I was real concerned when I first heard that because much as I wish that were true, it's my understanding of the law that that's not the case.
And who stated this? Her lawyer?
This was an argument that the mother's attorney was making.
Uh-huh.
In the case. That was part of the case.
Okay.
They lost at the federal district court level in West Virginia, and they appealed to the Fourth Circuit. Now, let me explain just real briefly. There are some, I think, 94 federal districts. Every state in the country has one or more federal districts. Every state has its own separate state court system. We have in this country a separate federal court system. Some issues are purely state law issues, and they will only ever be heard in state courts. Some issues are purely federal law issues. Some issues are a mixture of state and federal law, and vaccine religious exemptions, and in some instances even, I think, medical exemptions, are really a mixture of state and federal law. So these kinds of suits can be filed in either state or federal court when they go to court. And so in this case, the mother and her attorney opted to go to federal court in the first place. If you appeal from a federal district court, and that's the trial court level in the federal system, you go up to what's called a circuit court. There are 94 federal districts, one or more districts in every state, but there are only 11 numbered circuits for the 50 states, and each circuit has, I think, 3 to 9 states in the circuit. So the Fourth Circuit is where any federal case in West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, any federal case in any of those states, if it goes up on appeal, would go to the Fourth Circuit.
So what were the four states that was that in the Fourth Circuit? Is West
Virginia? Five states.
Five states.
Virginia and West Virginia, Maryland, okay. And then North Carolina and South Carolina.
Okay.
So this decision is actually what's called an unpublished decision, which means it doesn't serve as binding legal precedent, which is probably a good thing because for our purposes, because the mother lost the case.
Okay.
I would have been happy for the mother to win, don't get me wrong,
right.
But I was really skeptical about this case and wasn't at all surprised by the outcome. But it's a really good case to look at in terms of learning about and looking at some of the constitutional boundaries. So the facts in this case, in very quick summary, the mother has an older child that she believed had reactions to immunizations. So the mother wants to have a medical exemption for the younger child.
Right.
And when it went to court, she also claimed religious objections. But those objections seem to be based on the older daughter's vaccine adverse events. In other words, one of my children had vaccine reactions. God doesn't want me to do that to my other child.
Uh-huh.
Now, I haven't read the mother's statement of beliefs, but I've been making an inference, and I suspect
right.
from what I understand from the case, it was something along those lines.
Okay.
That right off the bat is a red flag for me legally. On a practical level, you know, parent to parent, that makes absolute sense. You know, I think there are a lot of parents mm-hmm. who concerned about vaccine adverse events might feel and honestly believe that. My God doesn't want me to expose my child to that risk. I mean, you could make medical mm-hmm. and religious and non-religious sort of common sense arguments about that. The
right.
problem is that there is legal precedent that says, in effect, if you mix concerns about religious beliefs and adverse events in the assertion of a religious objection, that you lose the exemption. And let me explain why I think that makes sense legally, even though potentially a court could come out with a different decision, and I could argue that as well.
Okay.
When states mandate vaccines, when the state legislatures mandate vaccines,
yeah.
they are presumed to have considered whether or not vaccines have any risks, whether or not vaccines are effective, whether they are necessary, whether, if they do have risks, the benefits outweigh the risks.
Mm-hmm.
So by the fact of the enactment of vaccine mandates, the enactment of a vaccine mandate carries with it, legally, a legislative presumption that there is a net benefit, that vaccines are safe and effective, that vaccines are necessary. Now, if you and I disagree with that, that's
right.
All well and good, but the place to take that disagreement is the state legislature. We need to go back to our state legislatures and say, you got this wrong, and here's why, here's the information, here's what really mm-hmm. goes on with vaccines. Courts.
So you're saying she went to the wrong court? She went to the federal?
Well, she went to the wrong venue. If the question for purposes of this point is, do you address this in court or do you address it somewhere else? And what I'm saying is the proper place to address that is the state legislature. And in fact, at oral mm-hmm. argument, and when they argued this case orally before the Fourth Circuit, one of the Fourth Circuit justices suggested to the mother and her attorney that they may need to take this case up with the state legislature. And in effect, saying exactly what I'm saying to you now, that
right.
the place to take that, because courts do not
Can she change? Can she go down there or not? Can she go to
where?
The other? Can she go to the state legislature at this point after a decision has been made?
Oh, yeah. The state legislature can. The state legislature is not limited by a court's ruling. See, what courts do, and here's the point, and here's why there's confusion on this point. Courts cannot second-guess state legislatures. They cannot go back and say to the legislature, you got it wrong. A court's job, a court's authority is to apply whatever the law is currently to whatever the facts in the situation before the court are. So, and this comes up all the time. I see, for example, when parents get into disputes about whether or not to vaccinate their kids, the pro-exemption parent wants to grab the first available alternative medical doctor, bring them into court, and have them argue that look at all the real problems with vaccines, look at what's really going on with vaccines medically. They really don't work. They really do cause serious injury. And therefore, you
right.
know, court, please rule that I don't have to vaccinate my kid.
That
the problem
work.
Is it's not the court's
yeah.
job is not to decide who's right about the science. The court's job is to weigh the evidence. And guess what? The weight of the evidence is profoundly in favor of vaccines because the CDC recommends them, the state health people recommend them, the majority of doctors recommend them. You can't win that argument in court. There are
okay.
other ways to deal with those issues and win in court, by the way, but that's just not the way to do it. So there's a question about, with some kinds of issues, what you know, one question is, what is the proper venue? Is court really a place where you can do this? But in any case, there's legal precedent that says if you mix vaccine, there was a case where the parent's testimony at trial was a mixture of assertions of religious beliefs and assertions about concerns about adverse events. And at the end of that court case, the court said, we hear you, your religious beliefs, but it's clear to us your larger concern is the adverse events. In other words, the court very politely was saying, the religious part appears to be a sham. You're really just concerned about adverse events. And that's not good enough for a religious
mm-hmm.
exemption. The main concerns here really aren't religious. So when you mix health concerns and
okay, is there
adverse
enough,
events.
Is there enough information that a parent could provide that shows how does a parent show that it is truly a religious motivation for their child?
Well, there's no short answer question that's detail about that. There are when I work with clients to put together what I call a statement of religious beliefs that are opposed to immunizations,
uh-huh.
There is also legal precedent that says if you copy something somebody else says, you're not being sincere. So
uh-huh.
the first two things you don't want to do when drafting your religious beliefs is say anything about vaccine adverse events
right.
and copy anything off the internet because
right.
those are the two quickest ways to lose the exemption. Now, what you do say, therefore, has to be, or a little bit like this, to have the strongest statement. And what I mean by that is the one most resistant or least vulnerable to a legal challenge. It has to be something unique to the parent or family. How you do that, though, does not reduce to a formula. And the reason I don't, for example, try to spell that out in my ebook is that when I work with clients to develop these statements of belief, it's an interactive process. We have to go back and forth. If it reduced to a formula, I'd publish the formula anywhere and everywhere I could to give people here's the answer to that question. But it doesn't reduce to a formula. Unfortunately, it's not that simple.
Right.
And there's lots of well-meaning anti-vaccine websites who think they're helping people by putting up, you know, sample statements and sample letters, and they invent their own affidavits and so forth. Sometimes those things work if you're in a state or a situation where they are not able to scrutinize the exemption claim. Those things may work. But if you're in a situation where the authorities do have the ability by law to the authority to scrutinize the exemption claim, those are very risky things to rely on.
Right. It seems to me, though, you know, this is my own personal view on this, that a religious exemption, I mean, the person is talking about the Creator, about God, about their relationship with the Creator and their God, their personal relationship, or cultural organizations, religious organizations' relationship. And there's just so much that you can say that, I mean, how individualized can it be when it's founded on, let's say, the Bible, and there are certain things in the Bible that indicate how you behave and communicate and treat your family, each other, and your relationship with God. I don't see how, and maybe I'm wrong, how individualized, unique it could be.
Well, let me say two things into that, because that was my thinking exactly as well. And I fully expected in my practice after a certain point that I'd start seeing the same thing over and over again, because there's only so much you can say and only so many verses in the Bible or whatever. I have been pleasantly surprised to say that even after working with hundreds of clients and families drafting these statements of belief, that they appear to me now more as fingerprints and snowflakes than they do as the same thing over and over again. Now, there are certain Bible passages that are commonly cited by Christians, you know, that I see in my practice. But even so, when people sit down to write their own statement, and then I work with them to help legally adjust it, legal purposes, you know, so that their beliefs are expressed in a manner that, you know, most effectively serves their goals and purposes.
Right.
But I haven't seen that as a problem, and I've been surprised by it, frankly.
Right. So, in other words, it's almost like, you know, the NPR show, The Story. So you're really giving a part of your life, your personal story, to show how you have that connection and how you come to this point in your life that says, this is something that I need to do for my family, for my children.
Well, it's not so much a story that someone writes, but it's rather what are right now your beliefs that are opposed to immunizations. People will often initially start off including lots of story kinds of information about how they got where they are, but that's not, for the most part, that's not really relevant. What's relevant is what right now are your beliefs that are opposed to immunizations. But the other thing is that people don't need to be too concerned about. You don't need to go to any extent to artificially ensure that your statement is absolutely unique. First of all, that's probably impossible to do. And it's not that your statement can't resemble somebody else's. Inevitably, some of these statements will. It's that if you go out and copy something that somebody else says, hey, use this, this works, you are then at risk of losing the exemption for having copied, because there's legal precedent that says copying means it's insincere. Now, the irony here is that you might copy for exactly the opposite reason. I had clients who copied something from somewhere else because they didn't know how to do this, and they wanted to make sure they got it right, and it backfired on them. So just because the legal precedent says that doesn't mean that's what's really true in your situation. But unfortunately, the way the legal system works is that one side comes in with legal precedent, the court can look at that and use that as a basis for making the court decision.
We have a question in the chat room asking, what if you're spiritual, quote unquote, and not religious?
Well, legal precedent defines boundaries. And let me give you one example that I think will answer that one beautifully. There was a case where the parents' quote-unquote religious beliefs stemmed from their prior association with three different tribes of Native American Indians. I don't think you can get much more unorthodox with regard to religion than that, and those folks had the exemption upheld. So the law doesn't try to confine us to religion as would be defined in a sort of conventional sense. There are boundaries, though. There was a case where a chiropractor lost the exemption. He was claiming that his religious beliefs stemmed from his chiropractic philosophy, and I think they used maybe language something along the lines of referring to natural order of things and so forth. At the end of the day, the court said that didn't get over the bar from philosophical to religious. You know, we're clear that you hold these beliefs sincerely; they're just not religious in nature. So it's not completely unbounded, but
right.
But there are pitfalls. But nonetheless, it is broad. What qualifies, and that's wonderful. The Supreme Court has, the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about religion in sort of really broad terms as beliefs going to ultimate concerns. So if your concerns, if your beliefs have to do with sort of the fundamental religious questions, who are we, where did we come from, why are we here, where do we go when we die, those kinds of questions in the broadest sense, those are things that, at least at this point in time, if ever, we can't answer scientifically, and so they come under the realm of belief, and you either believe these things or you don't, any particular belief or set of beliefs. And you can't really justify it or explain it in as you maybe can and need to, for example, with a vaccine medical exemption. You might have a doctor recommending it. You might have a State Department of Health that says, well, the reason you're recommending this doesn't fit our criteria, and you could have an argument medically, and you have to maybe bring in experts and get into the science. The beauty of religious beliefs is that you don't have to justify it. You just merely have to clarify what your beliefs are, because we have the right to believe anything we want to. Now, we don't have the right to do anything we want to based on those beliefs, and there have to be reasonable lines drawn. And, of course, that's where we get into disputes ongoing. Who gets to draw the lines? Where do they draw them?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, as you know, Debbie, from our prior shows, most states have laws that allow them to throw the religious and philosophical exemptions out the window if the state declares an emergency.
Right.
Well, you know, who gets to decide that and why? And you know, if we want to go back to state legislatures and say, wait a minute, you know, these religious and philosophical exemptions should apply in an emergency context just like they do any other context, you know, we have the right to do that. And my pandemic response project was formed for the purpose of doing that.
Okay. Let's see. Did we go through all of your points on this particular issue?
Fourth Circuit case. We just got started. We got sort of sidetracked there. I knew this was going to take us through the show, but it looks like it might carry us through two or three.
Well, it happens to be a really important topic with good questions that most people have. We've got about 14 minutes left. So this is appealed from a West Virginia federal district court, which you explained the court system so that the lay person could really understand where they need to go in a particular situation. And a doctor is initially approved, in this case, the doctor initially approved a medical exemption for the younger child, but the state later denied that exemption?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
this might
raise
more than one show.
That raised some interesting state issues, because it raises a really broad question. Or even if a doctor had recommended it and the state had initially denied it. I mean, it's a little more disturbing here when it was originally accepted and then later denied. But, it bothers me the idea that a person's private physician can make a recommendation and the state, who, of course, doesn't know anything about your personal medical situation, can say, no, we deny the exemption anyway. Now, granted, some doctors will work with their patients, do them more of a, maybe somewhat of a favor, more so than a clear, purely objective medical decision. So I guess there is some basis for a state to want to retain that authority. But in the grand scheme of things, I really feel like the private physician should have the final say and not the state there. So it's a really difficult issue, just the idea that the state can
override
don't know, a private physician.
We don't know at what point the state denied the exemption after they approved it. I mean, was it an immediate thing or it took time?
No, the child and the court opinion gives a little more detail on this. There was some period of time where the child was not having a problem because the child had a medical exemption. Now, just to clarify again, the younger child had a medical exemption because the older child had vaccine reactions. I'm not a physician, of course, but in just sort of common sense terms, that makes sense. If one child has a vaccine reaction, there could be a genetic predisposition. Let's not risk harm to any other children in the family. So it certainly makes sense that a doctor would make that recommendation.
Right.
The question comes in, at what point does the state have authority to overrule, in effect, the doctor or to say, we're sorry, we disagree? And that depends on the individual wording of each state's laws. Now, the court in this Fourth Circuit did not get to these state law issues, and we'll talk about that at some point. So I don't know whether or not that issue was addressed, and if so, whether or not the state law was complied with or not. But I do know that states have the authority to do that, and it just depends on the wording of each state's individual laws. In some states, if a doctor makes a recommendation, that's the end of the story. In other states,
depending on your state.
Right, depending on the state and the wording of laws. In other states, the health department can say, we don't care, you don't meet the criteria, you still have to get vaccinated.
Oh, we have Phyllis here. My good friend who was our special guest speaker, the homeopath Phyllis Georgic from Pennsylvania, is on the chat today, and she says, philosophical exemption, the religious exemption is only for religions that the family belongs to that has the vaccine issue listed in their tenets and their beliefs. Well, you would know best in regards to that.
There have been at least five states in the country where those kinds of laws have been challenged in court, and every time they've been challenged, they've been held to be unconstitutional. There still are states that have those kinds of laws, but there's federal legal precedent that says it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion, it doesn't matter which one you belong to. If you do, all you have to have is a sincerely held religious belief that is opposed to immunizations, and if it's religious and sincere, the First Amendment says you get the exemption. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I think it was Iowa, if I'm not mistaken, that has one of those kinds of laws. But actually, the health department has a form, and on the form, they don't ask you what your religion is. So the health department appears to be enacting the statute only to the extent that it's consistent with this federal legal precedent. So it's interesting. In other words, they seem to be recognizing that the statute is overreaching in its authority. So
we've spoken about that on earlier shows when we first started this show.
Yes. So Washington State right now is trying to pass a law, and so is New Jersey, both laws that require membership in organized religions. That is contrary to federal legal precedent. So if those laws get passed, they would be subject to challenge in court and should be stricken if they are challenged in court.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've gotten a lot of good information here today. I was going to ask you, is there a section in your ebook that talks about these particular issues about the religious exemption and what you just mentioned?
Absolutely, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to discuss that a little bit. My ebook, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, provides background on the law generally so that people have a better understanding of how the legal system works, but then in some detail about the specific parts of our Constitution that pertain to just these very issues and others concerning the constitutional support and where the boundaries are for that support, you know, what the limits are, and in particular for vaccine religious exemptions, because philosophical exemptions are generally pretty easy to exercise once you know that it's available if you live in a state where it is available. And medical exemptions usually require the involvement of a medical doctor. But the most widely utilized exemption and widely available, second only to the medical, is the religious, and it's also the most legally complicated. So the e-book does focus more on religious exemption rights than philosophical and medical, although it does talk about those as well. But since what qualifies for religious exemption is really broad, I mean, anybody who's not atheist could potentially qualify for a religious exemption.
Mm-hmm.
And so the focus is really on that. But yes, absolutely, the ebook does go into some detail on it. Now that link is on the, is it on the Blog Talk Radio?
What was your question?
The link to the ebook.
Yes,
I know
it is.
It's on the Homeopathy World Community, and is it also on the Blog Talk Radio?
Yes, it is. It's a little yellow square.
And I'll tell your listeners, if they click on that link, it will take them to my vaccinerights.com site with more information about the ebook. But if you go to my site by way of those links, and if you decide to purchase the ebook, the proceeds get split between my efforts and help support my volunteer work and legislative efforts, as well as Debbie's enormous volunteer time and uncompensated time with Homeopathy World Community. So I encourage folks to get the ebook because it's the only place you're going to find accurate, in-depth, reliable information on vaccine exemption rights. And with humble respect, I wrote the book in part to counter the well-intended but ultimately mixture of accurate and inaccurate information on anti-vaccine websites about vaccine rights and procedures. These folks mean well, and I certainly mean no disrespect. These are all my allies in raising awareness of vaccine issues, and I love them all.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't understand the law, and those that do have accurate information don't have it in any depth. So the ebook really is the place to get that. And
it's a good place
support.
To get started, yes.
Absolutely. And it's the purpose is to give you the information you need to be able to make informed decisions about exemptions. And that's really the key here. Sometimes you need an attorney, sometimes you don't. This will help you understand when you do or don't and why, for example. But it explains all this background information, the constitutional rights, the federal and state legal precedent, and how that applies in different situations. And then there are separate sections that talk about immigrations, vaccine custody disputes, a whole different, you know, sections on different arenas, military and so forth. So,
they're asking the name of the book. So if I, let me see if I can get, just
sure,
Vaccine Legal Exemptions ebook. It's on the Blog Talk Radio website, and you just click that little ad, and it'll take you directly there. Okay, let's see.
So this Fourth Circuit case was really fascinating to me, if a little depressing, predictably, but nonetheless depressing in its outcome, because I think it's very useful to help us understand where some of these legal boundaries are. As I've said, you know, in the past, we have the right to believe anything we want to with regard to religion. We don't have the right to do anything we want to. We can't go sacrifice a goat every Saturday night just because it's our belief that we are supposed to do that.
Really?
Well, I don't know about goats, maybe, but, you know, we can't sacrifice virgins. Let's say that one then, and we'll all understand, be on the same page with that one. But, no, I don't think animal cruelty laws probably wouldn't allow you to do goats either. But the point is that they're necessarily, when you use those extreme examples, we can see necessarily that there have to be boundaries, that people cannot be allowed to use a pretense of religion, even if it's true, to do anything they want to. So the question is, what are the boundaries? Who gets to decide? And the answer is those boundaries are in place in statutes and regulations for the most part, and then to some extent legal precedent interpreting the statutes and regulations. So we really have to look at all of those things, statutes, regulations, and legal precedent, if we want to know what are our rights in the particular set of facts in our situation and in our particular state or federal context. So unfortunately, it is a multifaceted issue and therefore more complicated than just simply yes or no, do I have the right or what right do I have in this situation? It's not always black and white. It's not always short and simple. In fact, with axiom religious exemptions, it's rarely anything but short and simple answer.
Mm-hmm. We have quite a bit of conversation going on in the chat room. So anybody who ever wants to visit Blog Talk Radio with us and find out what people are saying behind the screen here, you'll have to, because they're having a big old conversation all on their own, that you just have to click Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, and the chat is going live, and it is not saved. The chat is not saved, so whatever happens there, it's there. So you were saying we've got about 3 minutes left. Did you want to talk about the alleged First Amendment violation regarding religious beliefs, equal protection, and due process violations, the 14th Amendment rights? Or do you want to hold off for the – we have 3 minutes if you want to speak about that.
Well, this was this part of my notes was concerning just sort of kind of an overview of what the case was, and then potentially in a future show we can take these apart and talk about them in a little more detail. But the mother was alleging First Amendment violations concerning her religious beliefs. There were both free exercise and establishment clause violations alleged, and we can explain later, you know, what those were and what that means. There were alleged violations under the 14th Amendment, and that has to do with equal protection and due process, two different clauses in the 14th Amendment. And they also alleged violations of the West Virginia state statute or state code. And so there were several different arguments that the mother brought to the table, and the I think it's a very well-written opinion in the Fourth Circuit here. They went mm-hmm. through each of these one at a time and explained the court's reasoning and ultimately why that ended up saying, sorry, Mom, your kid has to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real challenge.
I guess she would have to move. I mean, I don't
well,
know
when people call me from Mississippi or West Virginia and they say, what can I do? And I say, well, you have two choices. You become legislatively active and win and keep and stay active until you win and get a law that gives you a religious exemption right. You can't do that in Mississippi, and I'll explain that another time. But in West Virginia, they have been trying to do that. Or you move, really. It's,
right.
It's that simple. And in terms of having a legal out. You know, I talked to somebody, a former U.S. resident who was in Central America and I years ago, and I said, so do they have vaccine requirements in where you are now?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, yes, but you can bribe the officials here. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I can never advise anybody to take that approach, and it's probably not a viable one here in the States. But,
probably
you know, there is
work.
A parent to parent, there is a point eventually where you say you do whatever you have to do to protect your parent. So I just can't advise anything unlawful to my clients. But I, as a parent, I support people in doing whatever they have to do to protect their children, especially. And so there may be other ways out, but in terms of the legal options, and those are the only ones that I can recommend. As far as I know, it's change the law or move.
Right. And some people are going to have a difficult time if their livelihood, their job, their husband or whatever is working in a certain place, or if you're stationed in the Army in Fort Bragg or someplace and, you know, you just are bound to be there. There's no way out. So what do you do? So
yeah, these are draconian times. These are draconian times. This is a bizarre
oh my
time
gosh.
To be alive. You
Our
know?
Time is up, and I'm going to say goodbye. This is fascinating.
Well, we'll follow up. Greg Glaser next week, folks. Come back. You don't want to miss that.
Fantastic. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
let your peace be observed. Walk by walk, we are reaching the world. But now we look for strength, renewal, and more of a build for you and me. Find our true expression. Allow our souls to shine. Reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light. Let your love be observed. What I want, we are changed. To make a lasting difference, you can't just have belief. It takes an act of loving will to cause the change you need. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. One by one, we are.